Du lyssnar på Tysklandspodden, en podcast från Goethe-Institut Schweden. I den här podcasten står Tyskland i fokus. Du hör samtal om litteratur, aktuella samhällsfrågor och kulturdebatter. Ibland är avsnitten på svenska, ibland på tyska och ibland både och. I det här avsnittet hör du den tyska författaren Angela Steidle. Hon talar med litteraturforskaren Jules Kielmann om sin senaste bok Aufklärung, ein Roman. En historisk roman som utspelar sig i staden Leipzig under upplysningstiden och som blev nominerad till litteraturpriset vid Leipzig bokmässa tidigare i år.
Hello, my name is Jules Kielmann. I'm a literary researcher at Uppsala University and I'm extremely happy to welcome the writer Angela Steidle here at the Goethe-Institut in Stockholm today, who has traveled to us from Cologne. Angela is not only a writer of fiction, but also a literary scholar. You received your PhD in literature from University of Siegen in 2002, with a thesis on lesbian motives in German literature from the 18th and early 19th century. And this interest in literature and history, biography and feminist historiography has followed you ever since. In numerous novels, biographies, and essays, you have reflected upon history as the present art and science and love as provocation. Researching scientifically, writing literary has become the trademark of your works. Angela has received many grants and prizes, the Gleim Prize for Literature, Bavarian Book Prize, Klopstock Prize for New Literature, for just to mention some of them. And her recent book, Enlightenment, a novel, was nominated for the prize of Leipzig Book Fair in the category of fiction. So this novel about the era of Enlightenment, a quite extensive book we are going to talk about today. So for those of us who have not read your recent book, maybe not even heard of it, could you introduce us a little bit to its word?
Oh, sure. And let me say, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad for the opportunity to talk to you. So my book, Enlightenment, a novel, is set in Leipzig, which was the center of the Enlightenment in the German-speaking countries in the middle of the 18th century. And the narration starts because Dorothea Bach, who is the eldest daughter of Johann Sebastian Bach, is mad about the biography that a certain professor of literature and philosophy, Johann Christoph Gottsched, has just written about his deceased wife. Her name was Luise, and Luise was a good friend to Dorothea's, as we later learn, also her lover and companion. But Dorothea thinks, while she's reading that biography of the husband of her friend Luise, this can't be true. Everything had been totally different. How can he write it in such a way? And so she starts her own version of history. And her memories go back to autumn 1734, when she met Luise Gottsched for the very first time. It was during a performance of the Coffee Cantata, which is actually true. It was performed for the first time in that autumn, exactly at the time when Bach was looking for a librettist to write a Christmas oratorio, so the texts for him. You know, all the words that do not come from St. Luke, but which are free lyrics. And he has just fallen apart with his former librettist, Henrizi, and so he's looking for one. And in the novel, it's going to be this young Luise Gottsched who will write the Christmas oratorio for him.
So exciting. The music of Bach, and especially his Christmas oratory, it is, you can guess by now already, quite central for the story. But I think it's not just history and gone. It's still a quite popular part of choir repertoires all over the world. I just saw when I got here an advert for Bach's Christmas oratory in 90 minutes to be given here at the Stockholm Concert Hall in January. Originally, the work takes about 3 hours, so that's our time of effective time management?
Well, originally it takes even 6 Sundays because it is written for 6 Sundays, each Sunday a cantata. Some people in the audience may love to have a short version, but I'm sure after having heard that short version, they are hungry for the original one. Actually, I lived in Uppsala 20 years ago for a whole year, and I joined a choir there. I'm a trained singer myself, and I love Bach. And so I was very happy to join the Collegium Cantorum there, which exists still today. And I was very happy to be part of the very lively choral scene in Sweden, in Uppsala especially. They taught me there that Uppsala is the choir city of Sweden. I don't know whether other cities would agree there. But I know that the Christmas Oratorio is right now rehearsed in many places in Sweden, as is abroad. And we listeners, we all have bought already our tickets for this time season.
I did mention that before, but it's true. You have some kind of jubilee this year, 20 years since you have been at the Center for Advanced Studies at Uppsala. So it's great that you now are back in another kind of role, now a literary writer, but as we we'll talk about more. There is this red thread, I think, between history and biography and writing. Feminist history, maybe we could say? A literary history of women?
Yes, sure. On the content layer, for sure. I think we need to retell patriarchal history. It's not about adding women's history to general history. It's to think history anew. And I'm trying to do this with the help of focusing on women. So, for example, in this novel I brought to you, Enlightenment, we have a lot of historical personalities, female ones who really existed and attributed a lot to Enlightenment. When it comes to physics, to theater reform, to everything, it's just they have been forgotten mostly. And so if we want to rethink Enlightenment, we have to think about the women and their share in the process of thinking as well.
I completely agree. I know that there's this research project at the University of Gothenburg right now where they are focusing on women's contribution to Enlightenment thinking in the city of Gothenburg. So I think gladly, there are more attempts in different parts of the world that are rethinking and rewriting history and our idea of enlightenment. We have talked about that before earlier, but
I would like to go into it and at the same time tell a little bit more about my novel. I gave you the introduction, so to say, the setting where the novel starts. And following her memories, Dorothea writes down what she remembers from history from this 1734 meeting with Louise Gottsched on. But while she is writing, she realizes, oh, it's not that easy to recall. And it's not easy to find words for what I recall. Words have their own pitfalls. Via writing, something changes. And then she gives her memories, while she's writing them, to her younger sisters. Dorothea Bach historically had 3 younger sisters. They lived in poverty. In Bach, after her father's death and her mother's death, Anna Magdalena. And in the setting of my novel, so the younger sisters read what Dorothea has written, and all of a sudden they say, no, you are not be true. You can't be true. They remember the same situations that Dorothea describes, but quite differently. So they challenge the memories of Dorothea as she challenged the memories of Johann Christoph Gottsched to begin with. And after some 400 pages in the novel, they even prove to her that Louise Gottsched cannot have written the libretto of the Christmas Oratorio, which is very crucial. And actually, it's historically correct. Louise Gottsched cannot, because she arrived 4 months too late for that in Leipzig. Up to now, to today, we do not know who has written the libretto of Bach's most beloved work worldwide. There is still one piece of paper of the original performance with the words, and there is no author written on it, which is kind of strange, because all his male librettists put their names on it. So there is a void. And, you know, not scientifically speaking, I say, sure, this libretto has been written by a woman, because every guy would have put his name on it. But we do not know. So this is his, now I was talking history, back again to my novel. Here, it's also not true that it was Louise Gottsched. But this news now is shocking Dorothea in the novel, and she has to rethink everything she has written so far. And by thus, I hope to include into the novel on the narration level all the ideals of the Enlightenment, which I still admire, meaning, criticism, think, rethink, embrace even unwilling truths, try again, be open for arguments, change your minds, talk to each other about plausibility and everything. So the whole process that is defining enlightenment, not the historical epoch, but the process of thinking. This is how I try to incorporate it into the novel on the narration level.
I see. So the reader might be as shocked as Dorothea is and her sisters on page 400, realizing, but I always thought it was Louise. But if she's not, what did I read by now? Can I really trust Dorothea as a remembering subject?
Exactly. Thank you so much for your reaction, because this is exactly how I want my readers to react. They too become part of the enlightening process. They also have to think, who, what can I trust here? And it's it might sound a little bit complicated when I explain it like that, but actually there are many jokes and it's quite a fun story.
Yeah.
So I hope my readers will trust and laugh with me, saying, yes, she's right, we need to check ourselves.
Yeah,
and nobody can do this for us. We are ourselves responsible.
Exactly. We if Dorothea is in the position of rethinking the history Gottsched has written about Louise, we are forced to rethink Dorothea's sisters, what Dorothea has told us all the way through. And of course, that makes something with our. We have to be alert as readers. We have to think ourselves, which is obviously the core of your enlightening project, I guess, as a writer, isn't it? We have to think.
We have to think. I'm very glad that you put it in exactly these words. You know, when you write a novel for 3-4 years, you're so lonesome. And think about, oh, could this work? And I want my reader at this point to think that and that. And you try. And I always have early readers who check with me during the writing process whether I'm on that path I'm hoping for. But it's very rewarding when you see, like you put it now, that things come true. Yes. It's exactly what I wanted. I want the reader first to identify and love the story and then realize, okay, by loving it, I have to rethink it and look at it critically. And that's the enlightening process.
Yeah, it's really in practice, actually. I remember Dorothea explaining to her sisters or defending herself when the sisters say, oh, you have to be lying, you can possibly remember all the conversations you had like 40 years ago, how how could you write it as if it had happened yesterday? And she says, every kind of history telling is always some kind of subjective version of the actual truth. So if there's always kind of imagination, why shouldn't I make up everything? Mm-hmm. And is that, could we read that as some kind of your own poetics?
Oh, sure. The novel is about the Enlightenment as a period, and as we said before, it also reflects the way of thinking and talking about the Enlightenment. So the question, in which kind of language can I present that plot and time, is a very crucial one. And you can believe me, I thought quite a while about it. I finally decided for a first-person narrator, who is Dorothea Bach, because it gave me a lot of freedom as a narrator, as well as the possibility to show somebody in her day. I had the first 50 pages at the beginning written in the third perspective, third person perspective. So that is when the coffee cantata takes place in the Zimmermannische Kaffeehaus. Yes. A very nice scene with many characters, a proper introduction to the novel. And I realized, okay, if I do it in the third person, then this is just another historical novel.
Yeah.
And I have to describe tapestry and tablecloth, and my readers would expect me to describe clothing and everything like a travel guide. And this is not what I want. This is not the the fun also of language and of reflected language that I'm yearning for. And already by then I knew that I would invent a plot around Dorothea Bach, having all kind of historical important personalities. Of those I speak in the novel, so to say, history book proof. You can make a fact check about them. And
even footnotes in some spots.
I would call them seductions for further reading.
Okay.
But around Dorothea, it was possible to invent a plot because we know so little about her. So there were or are many voids where nobody can tell me, no, this isn't true, you can't say so and so, because no one knows. All my inventions are probable. They could have been, but it could have been completely different, but no one will ever prove wrong or right. And the personal narrator, first-person narrator in Dorothea's voice gave me the possibility to play with that talking I. Who is the I that is narrating the text? Because like Dorothea, I also look from the present back to the 18th century. Dorothea, we learn in the text, is writing in 1763, and she was looking back 30 years. I'm writing in 2021, looking back 300 years. Yeah. But this gave way for many possibilities to play with this I, who is the talking, really the talking person. And that inspired me to put in some blatant anachronisms so that reader will like and love the 18th century, but will always be reminded that this text was written in the 21st century. And actually that the novel is reflecting our own times or mirroring while telling a story of the 18th century.
Yeah, definitely. But it's still that although we are following Dorothea Bach as a protagonist and seeing everything with her eyes, or at least with her inner eye and her memories, you manage to put a lot of information on the 18th century, on food, on Christmas traditions, decoration, clothes, about so many things, not to talk about musicology and music theory inside, that it still, even if it's Dorothea that is taking the lead, we learn a lot. We learn so much. It just doesn't feel like it. Why are we doing it? Because it's fun.
Thanks a lot. You can imagine it was hard work to make it as elegant and light as possible. That was my game. Readers should love the novel without realizing how much they learn. That was also the possibility the first-person narrator gave me. If I had written it in third person, this maybe would have seemed to be like a history book, and now I explain you that, and now we need to know this. While with the first-person narrator, Dorothea, she is taking us along in her realities, and that was gave me the freedom not to explain everything, but just the things she is wondering about.
Yeah.
And she's intelligent, but she's not educated, as were all 11 daughters of Johann Sebastian Bach, at least those who survived. So she's smart and has her eyes open, and she's kind of our secret travel guide to the 18th century. And I constructed the plot in a way that all our answers, our questions, are made in the plot as her questions. She is wondering what Luise Gottsched is doing. She's wondering about the books Johann Christoph Gottsched is writing. She is commenting on the works of her father, the compositions. She's telling us that the boys' choir of St. Thomas School isn't in good mood today. And the setting is so attractive.
Yeah.
I choose Leipzig on purpose, not only because it was the place where Johann Sebastian Bach lived as a Thomas Cantor and musical director, because it really was the center of the Enlightenment. That had to do with this happy triad of the university, the book printers' business, and the fairs, the trade fairs. And altogether meant there was quite liberal, surprisingly liberal thinking, which was printed directly on the spot, because Leipzig was the book city of Holy German Empire. And they traded with the ideas of Enlightenment, those booksellers, when they sold their books on the fairs. So they even made money with thinking. And they reformed the theater in Leipzig at that time. Imagine that. They got rid of the slapstick comedies exactly in that period when Johann Sebastian Bach was Thomas Cantor there. No one ever explained that simultaneity to me. And so this historical material for me is so attractive and opens so much questions for me. I always was looking for the book who would explain that to me, and when I didn't find it, I realized I had to write it for myself.
You definitely have done so. I wonder, especially when you talk about the theater, we have Gottsched there, who is constantly talking about the potential of the theater to educate people, to make them enlightened citizens. Then we have Bach, whose music is very, it's so much more than just entertaining. It's, I guess, educating in another way, at least religiously almost.
I'd say intellectually.
That's what I was thinking of. Exactly. So it's not only that you had to describe so many things about literary history and like the evolution of German drama and music and the city of Leipzig and its intellectual life and all the historical stuff. it's also the language. You talk about the language before. How did you do all that? I mean, how, as we, when we had a sneak preview or a sneak peek to your workshop, like how do you work? How do you do that?
Okay. Actually, Enlightenment, the novel, is kind of a sum of my work to date. I have written several biographies and have been thinking theoretically about biography. It's why it's so attractive, why it's so problematic, where's the dilemma, where's the fun of it, where I have to be careful, as a reader and as a writer, both. And biography is a lot about history telling in a smaller scale, so to say, but still with the same problems that telling history has. And when we are talking about telling history, we are talking about telling a story. Yeah. This is where the author comes in. And as I'm trained in literature from studies and PhD, I know that novels can tell a lot about reality. So I trust fiction in broadening our horizon and giving us something to think and learn about ourselves. So for me, it's not an opposition on the one side, science on the other, literature. But I try to give people both entertainment and education with my novels. And in this book, Enlightenment, there is really, let's say, 45 years of listening and singing Johann Sebastian Bach. So, and there is 30 years of studying German literature, especially of the 18th and 19th century. And there is my own career as a writer. Everything is in it. And when I constructed and maybe as a fourth point, there's just a lot of reading simply for this book's sake. For example, you mentioned the cooking and the recipes. Yeah. I adore them too. I found them in the Frauenzimmer lexicon, meaning it's a lexicon only for women back then, they thought. It's very funny to read. It's recipes and female women, like empresses and so, and nothing else.
Okay.
First I read this, just, you know, look an article here, how to brew beer, for example. Then I was looking for something else. But then I realized, no, I have to read this from beginning to the end. The whole lexicon, 1,000 pages, because all the details I'm longing for is that what I not know yet. It's when I started, I thought, okay, I flip through this in one day. But then I only looked up the things I already knew, and I didn't need that. I needed the surprises. And that's why I really read the whole lexicon.
Wow.
And the good recipes were these surprising ones that I did not look for. But you asked me for my writing technique. So I gave you the sources where it all comes from. And then sometimes I thought my head is too small for this whole material. So I had to write it in layers, so to say. I carefully planned when which composition of Bach is included in the novel. For a while, I didn't do anything else, but carefully see, okay, I will make Christmas Oratorio great, because this is where it starts from. And everything of the composing process with Johann Sebastian Bach, I can explain there. So that he writes his the scores, but other people like Dorothea and his pupils and his sons make it into individual voices. We say voices in German, I'm not sure how you call it in English, but meaning that the violin knows what to play, the second violin, the alto part, and so on. So the whole process, like from his compositions, really it turned into performances. This is all part of the Christmas oratorio chapters in the beginning, where we learn how the workshop Bach and Thomas School really worked. And so I have stated that in the novel, and I need repeat it later on, because I know my readers are smart and they still have that in mind when we go on to other performances. And then I had to... I would have loved to describe every possible performance of Bach's compositions, but I knew, okay, no, that's going to be boring. I have to find different ways of telling, for example, about Bach's music. So once we have a performance, in another occasion, Dorothea is looking at the scores and so on, to make it lively and to have variations in it. And so for a while I just sticked to the music, read a lot about Bach. I'm following the famous scholar Christoph Wolf, who has opened my eyes to Bach as an Enlightenment composer and not a Baroque composer. I totally follow him, as Christoph Wolf, in depicting Bach like that. And other aspects of the novel, like the theater reforms, I made them for half a year, so I just concentrated on how I have theater present, because there again, I can describe a performance in which Dorothea sits and she's wandering a while, but I cannot repeat that. So if I want to talk about another important drama on the stage that happens, I have to find different ways in variation. And well, that's narration technique. It's a craft and an art. And so I, all in all, the text was shaped in layers, kind of. And it's always the same. I know it from the beginning when I first have the first draft in a way that someone else can read it and understand it. I know I have at least one third too much. And I have a long, purposeful editing process by myself, shortening, forgetting my own text. That this is very important. I try to make long vacations or even write a small, totally different text, so that I, when I again read my own text, it has become estranged and has to convince me. This is really very important. Then it's all the study is over. Then it's only about shaping from a kind of text to a really good text. And this is a long editing process of at least 7 or 8 re-editions with shortening and really focusing what do you want to tell, and this is too wordy. And sometimes you realize you have worked, let's say, 8 weeks on a chapter, and you find out in the ending, this is not leading anywhere. Get rid of it.
Kill your darlings. When I hear you talking about your way of writing, it reminds me quite a lot of Dorothea and her comments on writing, and also other figures in the novel. I remember this Grillparzer quote which you used. Is it to read about music is like to read about lunch. It's we know it. The sensations, the emotions, the senses are missing. Mm-hmm. It's hard, and that, I guess, that is exactly what you just described. To avoid writing about music, which is hard in the first place, but you have to make it for this novel to work, and you make it with bravura. Obviously, I mean, I was like wanting to read about Bach's music after it, although I just had read so much about it in your novel, but you just want to learn more. But on the same time, you have to change the way you do it all over again. And once again, you can't repeat yourself. That's what you just said. And that is what I think Dorothea also is reflecting on. Yeah, mm-hmm. She is, how do I have to do this? How can I make this right? And I think it's interesting what you said about the choice of her as a first-person narrator, because if you had continued with the third-person narrator, then we had had this instance of someone knowing everything, mm-hmm. being able to describe everything. All this self-reflexive irony thing would have collapsed. I think it's so perfect that you chose Dorothea and that we can follow her, because it makes it so vivid for mm-hmm. us.
Thank you very much. You're really very kind. I give you one little secret of my writer's workshop when it comes to writing about music. First of all, let me mention Thomas Mann, whom I really adore, and who is the big master when it comes to write about music in novels. In Enlightenment, a novel, I try to make these musical performances and this what we could sum up as musicology, but which it isn't because it's a narrated story. I try to make it as vivid as possible, because there is not only music going on in that scenes. As you might assume, it's a lot about love and seduction and who gets whom. It's about these professors quarrel all the time. They like to fight unrational thinking, but they prefer to fight each other. And all such things around the plot and characters are always going on at the same time while we are listening to music. So it's never that, okay, now the reader has to go through this musicological part, no. But we are in the story and get all these ideas about music, so to say, on the side as an extra. And this was the way I hope to present my musical writing in an entertaining way. And right, as you said before, just in your last remark, without this first-person narrator, it would have been hard to get any irony into this text. Yeah. And the whole novel, in a way, is highly ironic.
Yeah.
As I explained earlier, we start with someone who thinks she knows about history and later on has to learn she hasn't. So it's a completely ironic set, which I hope everybody will enjoy. It's not meant to be cynic. It's meant to be loving, I even would put it, and humane.
Solidary, I think it could be
it
said.
Could be said, yeah. Too, yes, yeah. We come very close to this Dorothea because I made her so close to us, for sure. I gave her some characteristics which are very far from us, with all the housewifing things she does, and there is superstition still lurking, and such things that we think, oh, Dorothea, what are you now thinking? or she pretends always knowing the sex of the little unborn child when her stepmother is pregnant. So I gave her things of the 18th century, but for sure I gave her things not only of myself, but of our time. I do this knowing that historical reflection, or that proper history, as you teach it as in the universities, also knows that history is always written from the present and for today's readers. There is no thing that we can ever know how it was in Leipzig in 1750. We do have the sources, but we have to interpret them. And as it shows, every generation interprets them a little bit differently. Mm. For example, if you look at biographies on Caesar, let's say, every 50 years you have another Caesar, whether your biography is meant for a democratic audience or for a monarchic audience, whether you yourself are a feminist or not, your view on Caesar will be quite different from others, although the sources remain the same. So history in general is told from the present time on, and knowing the support from my colleagues at the history department, so to say, I dared to incorporate these thoughts into my novel too, making clear in the end the reader will know, okay, we have this lovely narrator, which is called Dorothea, and she gave us her story. But someone else has done the overall design of the novel. And this is obviously the author, Angela Steidle, with her ideas.
Yeah. In Sweden, we had this autumn, had this cultural debate on contemporary literature being very much not even just autofiction, but sometimes just auto, just biography, just reflecting on contemporary writers' everyday life, their own passions, their own thoughts, their precarious existence. And there were, it was questions whether that even could be literature. And then I read a novel like yours, which is talking or having a main character in a historical distance of 300 years in Leipzig. Why did you do that? Why did you do that to us? Why did you do that to yourself when everyone else seems to write uncensored about their own life?
Yeah. You know, I think literature is huge. It's bigger than we all. And thank God. And there are many ways of writing and reading at the very same time. So I'm fine with autofiction, and it has a lot to tell. It's just not my way of writing. I reflect in every book I write, especially in my biographies, that for sure my texts do in some way show who I am. I'm a feminist, I'm a Democrat, I live in the 21st century, and so on. This is obvious in my texts. And I try to reflect it openly for the reader. But I am, as a person, I'm not interesting. But Bach is, and his day, and the Enlightenment period. So I choose other ways of telling today's story. And actually, I see Enlightenment novel rather as a historical novel that makes fun of historical novels, because it's about our present, in, you know, if you look at it from a distance. The starting point, why did I write this novel at all, actually was desperation of our own times. For 10, 15 years now, things are changing, and I think we live in neo-irrational times. If I just give you the catchwords Brexit, Trump, Bolsonaro, not to mention Putin, for example, or those who are against vaccination all of a sudden. Everything irrational and open lies, which you can argue against, and which are easy to prove that they are lies, all such horrible wrong thinking is now on the agenda again. And we nice liberal people have to fight that such crazy ideas which come up all of a sudden, although they are completely stupid, and we have to use our precious lifetime to prove that this is wrong, all these lies. And so my growing desperation about my own times, which I call neo-irrational, made me think of the first epoch when they got rid of their irrationalities, namely the Enlightenment. And then I started to think, oh yes, my God, look at the parallels. Look, like someone like Trump can even use the word witch hunt 100 times a day, you know, which is now really not a term proper to our times. He comes back to irrational times because he is irrational, obviously. Although one man is not the problem, the Republican Party is the problem as a whole, but that leads us to completely different things. I just wanted to stress that I had our own times in mind when I looked back so far 300 years ago.
So it's not completely far from yourself, only fiction, but there is still this ongoing Enlightenment project. Maybe it's some kind of Enlightenment 2.0, which we are reading or hopefully going to see.
Yes.
Quite soon.
I agree. That's the point. And that's also why I invite the reader during reading the novel to be part of the Enlightenment process. It's all about us. We all have to think together, amicably, tenderly, and to make things good.
Thank you so much, Angela Steidele.
Thank you very much.
Du har lyssnat på Tysklandspodden, en podcast producerad av Goethe-Institut Schweden.